From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, Colin Firth, walking through his career is kind of like walking through a library. He's done some Oscar Wilde. He's done some Shakespeare. He's played Shakespeare, as a matter of fact. One of my favorite pieces, The Blackadder. He's also been in some Joseph Conrad, To Helen Fielding. But he's done some original things, too. In fact, one of my favorite movies of his, Apartment Zero, relates to his new film in some ways, the adaptation of Christopher Isherwood's A Single Man. First of all, Colin, thanks so much for being here.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
The reason I was reminded of Apartment Zero when I saw A Single Man is they're both pieces about guys who are going through extraordinarily tragic circumstances and are forced to recognize some parts of themselves that they hadn't recognized before. Because of another man in both cases.
It's interesting. It hadn't occurred to me. Apartment Zero was a film which got under my skin. And they're both men who are living in isolation. And come to think of it, they're both men who seem to be trying to defend themselves against the world with a kind of external fastidiousness. I mean, Apartment Zero is not set in the past, but Adrian sets himself very much in the past. He would love to be Cary Grant or Montgomery Clift or one of the pictures he has hanging on his wall. There's something in common just in terms of the universe that these men create for themselves.
There have been so many adaptations and a tragic cast to many of them.
Of?
And the characters that you played.
You know, I don't think I've had more than my share of loss or grief in my life. And maybe there's something to do with disposition or some way I view the world. I remember years ago a fellow actor asking me, I think almost within reference to the iconic mime masks of the smiling face and the sad face, which is your primary impulse, as if all actors would probably err one way or the other. Is it to make people laugh or to make them cry? I think we both, without hesitation, said, cry. This is when I was about 25 years old, and I'd never been cast in a comedy. And it wasn't until I was in my mid-30s, actually, that I think it started to happen. I remember thinking around that age, will I ever cast in a comedy? And cut to 10 years later, of course, and, you know, I've got people writing things about me saying, you know, we're not used to seeing him in anything other than a romantic comedy. So, you know, but the fact remains that I think I'm much more engaged with the stories that make the heart ache than the stories that lighten the soul.
I almost wondered if you felt like you had to find yourself as an actor to be comfortable in doing comedy. Because I do think it's almost everyone has said that comedy is a more difficult thing to do.
Yes, I don't think I've ever felt entirely comfortable doing comedy.
Really?
Not really. And often even when I've been in a comedy, I haven't been. There are all sorts of different comic skills and facets to the people who have comic skills. And, you know, there's the Buster Keaton character who never smiles or twinkles. There's the loquacious comic creature, the witty one. There's the, you know, the Oscar Wilde, Wildean, you know, no coward figures who are masters of the bon mot. And then there are the Stooges. And I think in some ways that's been where I've been put on the whole. I've often been the straight guy. You know, when I say Stooge, I don't mean, you know, the pratfalling Stooge necessarily.
But the straight man, who's the butt of the joke to some extent.
Yeah, I'm the guy, yeah, the joke's on me rather than the man who, you know, espouses the wit. It's not been an uncomfortable position, but it's not been always the most inspiring place to be. I think comedy, whatever kind of comedy you're doing, whether you're playing it straight or not, and I'm not dismissing the art of playing it straight. I think there's something, you know, the people who do it well, I admire enormously. The margin of error is minute. It's a high wire act. I find it with drama, it's broader. You can take risks which can pay off in all sorts of directions. Comedy, if you miss by a millimeter, you've missed altogether. I think the people who do it best, I've watched actors trying to master it on film. And, you know, film is catching lightning in a bottle. It's got to happen while that camera is rolling. In order to be in the state where that kind of spontaneity is possible, in the right moment, when the camera is rolling, and there are no focus problems, and there are no lighting problems, and the sound man is doing it, doing his job properly, and there are no planes going over, and you get your timing right in that moment, then you've nailed it. That is very, very unusual. The time you nail it, and someone says, "No, I'm sorry, we're going to have to go again. A truck went by, or the camera, there was a shake on the camera," and you try capturing that again. And I've seen actors go to the monitor and check and say, "No, the timing was a millisecond too late or a millisecond too early. We've got to do it again." And in the end, spontaneity gets replaced by obsessive repetition, and you don't really have time for excessive repetition on a film. You can squander it on trying to get one line right, and then you leave no time for the stuff you've got to do for the rest of the day. That's the nature of comedy on film, I think. With drama, I don't want to be reductive about it, but I find that there's more freedom than that. You can cry a little bit more, a little bit less. The emotion can be a little bit more demonstrated or a little bit more restrained, and it could work either way. It's not necessarily as dependent on this minute area of, of precision.
It's a treatment. I'm talking to Colin Firth, a little about comedy, also about drama. His new drama as actor is the adaptation of A Single Man. You play characters, we can always talk about your protagonist of Single Man, who, had you moved to a millimeter to the left or right, could be an object of ridicule. He could be kind of ridiculous because of this rigidity in which he addresses the world.
Possibly. Although I felt free.
Did you?
In doing it, yeah. But the fact that the character is so circumscribed and so fastidious didn't necessarily mean that I felt that way as an actor. Quite to the contrary. I knew what his mask consisted of, and I knew how dependent he was on that. But I think his emotional world, which I was invited to inhabit, was one that was pretty wild and chaotic. I think that's what made the character so interesting to me. I think that
the extent to which he was attempting to tamp down that world?
Yes. I think that the cufflinks and the tie-pin and the suit and the product in his hair and the shined shoes are all instruments against chaos. I think that they are signs of desperation. And I think there have been people who watch this film and think they're signs of Tom Ford wanting to flaunt his visual sense. But that's not what's going on. I mean, just subjectively speaking and being there, all those elements were critical to me in informing what was going on inside George. I mean, the fact that he wakes up in a state of almost hysterical despair and bothers to put himself together that way already told a story to me. You know, that he had to hang on by his fingernails until he made it to the end of that day when the fatal decision comes. He just has to get to that point. And it's not just a weapon against desperation or inner chaos. I think it's also a weapon against the outer beauty of life, which keeps assaulting him and trying to encroach and trying to call him back to the will to live. And that's a very interesting conflict that takes place in a script which, on first reading, doesn't seem to have a plot. You know, this is a man who starts off in one state with a complete commitment to give life up altogether. And everything that happens to him is a challenge to that. And it's a very, very difficult thing to pull off with elan. And I think that Tom has done an extraordinary job in orchestrating that. And each one of these gorgeous images we see are not just pieces of style. They are conflicts.
No, and specifically, because we talked about this when Tom was here a few weeks ago, I thought an imposition of that character's will. I mean, it's probably one of the most subjective films of all time, because I assume that this whole thing is, we're seeing it through his eyes and the way he's ordered the world, which is why it looks like that. It's his point of view being exercised throughout the film.
That's right. It's his point of view being exercised throughout the film, but he's not indulging those images. He might seem to for a moment, but each one of those experiences becomes a challenge to his decision. it makes it more difficult for him to see it through. I don't think he necessarily knows that's what's happening each time. Whether it's his secretary when he arrives at college and he smells her perfume and realizes how beautiful she looks with her hair up, he absolutely inhabits that moment because it's probably the last time he will ever see her. Maybe it'll be the last time he ever sees a woman with her hair up. Maybe it'll be the last time he ever smells Arpège, the perfume, you know, maybe. And so these things have a resonance and a power that they've never had before because he's never looked at things knowingly for the last time before in his life. This time they become so powerful that they start to endow life with a texture it's never had. And I don't think he thinks at that moment, maybe I can't go through with my decision. Life's beginning to get richer by the minute. But I think cumulatively by the end of the day, these things have conspired to make it harder and harder for him to actually give up on life.
It's a treatment. I'm talking to Colin Firth. His new film is the adaptation of A Single Man, for which he won the acting award at the Venice Film Festival. But that orderliness that we're talking about leads to a scene that's both tragic and comic, the suicide attempt. It's that insane obsessiveness of getting all the details right, but then basically asking those questions, well, what kind of mess I'm going to leave literally if I do this?
And actually, I think one of the things that is appealing to me about George is that he is relentlessly polite and considerate. And I think there's something very touching.
Well, except to the kids next door.
Well, that's quite right. And I think he relishes tormenting that family. I think that's just, he's just giving the finger to the suburbs, basically, and to suburban life. And I think I can quite well understand it. You know, there was something that was particularly poignant because when we were filming this, the day actually that we filmed the scene where George gets the phone call with the news of his lover's death and then told that, no, you can't come to the funeral because it's family only. That was the day Prop 8 was passed in California. And you think, well, you know, we can patronize the past if we like and pity those poor unenlightened people from 1962, but we've just done something so retrograde here that I don't think we're really in a position to look down from a great height. And I remember coming to work that afternoon because we shot mostly at night, and there were all these families out, you know, these waspish, perfect suburban families who were just like the Strunks with their kids, with placards in favor of Prop 8. And you just sort of think, well, what is this? You know, smile and honk for discrimination, you know. And I thought, my God, you know, in some areas we have not moved on in any way. I mean, that's not the focus of our story. But
it gives it certainly extra resonance, does it not?
It gives it extra resonance. And I think it does something. It goes some way to explain George's attitude to his neighbors anyway. But then again, that little girl who lives across the street is the girl who appears in the bank as something sort of hyper-real. She's not the neighbor across the street anymore. She's the last child he'll ever see. And as such, you know, there's this extraordinary, vibrant, melancholic fascination with her. I mean, he's rendered speechless by the sight of her. Even though she's saying these terrible things, you know, my father thinks you should go in the Colosseum, and, you know, he says you're light in your loafers, and George, he's just absolutely fixated by how beautiful a child can be.
Wow, I'm almost speechless. We'll take a break. My guest is Colin Firth. His new film as actor is the adaptation of A Single Man. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is actor Colin Firth, whose new film is an adaptation of A Single Man. I guess, though, we were talking before, the way you were describing George and that tenuous grasp of what passes for reality for him and that fight to hold on to it, it's almost like a description of schizophrenia.
even if he's not schizophrenic, I think it's a pretty schizophrenic day, if that makes any sense. I think that his motives are being split all the time. And it's irrational. The day is irrational. Why? He does things which are only a person who's going to continue to live will bother to do. His need to conduct that day with dignity and his need to express a certain amount of thoughtfulness to the people, the few people actually that really are in his life, including the woman who cleans his house, making sure that she gets her money in the, you know, knowing that she always puts the bread in the freezer, so that's where he leaves it, giving her a kiss on the cheek and telling her she's wonderful one last time. And the reason he wants to get the suicide right is that he knows that she's the person that's going to find the body and have to clean up the mess, so he's still thinking of her. He's got a pile of suicide notes and letters that he wants to make sure are resolved for people. This is all stuff that it may seem morbid, but it's actually entirely connected with life. And it's entirely to do with connectedness.
It's also his need to, even after his death, not put the world out of order. I mean, things should continue with a minimum of fuss.
And why should he care? That's the contradiction. You know, if it's over and that there's such a complete void underneath the surface, why is he fulfilling all these things, which I think are basically life-affirming?
Again, because of the going back to Adrian and apartments here, I hate to keep harping on this, but I find myself thinking that in both cases, you got the real pleasure of playing those contradictions that are not evident but apparent and known best of the character rather than anybody else.
Well, I think one thing that is similar as well in both, you know, one of the things both the characters certainly have in common is if you go back to Adrian and Apartment Zero, he also has split motives. He's a fierce misanthrope. He does not want to know his neighbors. He will do anything to avoid them. In fact, his heart sinks, I think, right at the beginning of the film. He walks into this building and they're all arguing on the staircase and he has to almost hold his breath to walk past them. And he is trying to keep the world at bay, trying to keep them out. I mean, apartment zero, zero is the number on his apartment. The one's gone on the 10. And it's he's living, willfully living, in a kind of void. And at the same time, he's frantically reaching out in some way. He's more externally desperate than George. George has a far more wry expression to the world.
But he's also really on the verge of disintegrating psychologically.
Yes, he is.
In the film.
Yes, he is. But he's a little bit better at masking it with a sort of air of the urbane than
Adrian. Yes, but both those characters are just almost Adrian, especially because he's in that cave all the time.
That's right.
Can't hide it from himself.
No.
Whereas George has become quite expert at hiding
that's right.
it from himself.
I was going to say, Adrian's worse at it. I mean, Adrian, we have to remember, is about 20 years younger as well.
Sure.
So I was 20 years younger.
as were we all.
That's right. I think, you know, Adrian just didn't have it quite as refined. I remember actually one of the ways in which I ended up fashioning the physicality of Adrian, because it's one of the characters on which I worked hardest at the physicality, was that I think he's a person who would probably, if he were not self-conscious and not desperate, would be physically out of control, flamboyantly out of control, that his arms would go all over the place. And I remember working harder and harder at bringing those gestures into making them smaller and smaller, but they were still there. So Adrian has a kind of pinched quality, but the fingers and the arms pop up and you get these sort of little spasmodic gestures, which are often not particularly related to what he's saying.
It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is actor Colin Firth, whose new film is A Single Man. And I felt that was a way of, again, of finding comedy in that, just because he would start to move and suddenly his eyes would go, his face wouldn't move, but his eyes would go directly to his hands as if,
right,
what's
yes.
possessed me
yes.
that I can't control?
That's true. And he's jumpy. And actually, Adrian's Argentinian, which is an interesting thing. He's an Argentinian seeking to be an Englishman. Martin Donovan, who directed the film, who is Argentinian himself, said there's an old adage that the Argentinians say about themselves. But he described Argentinians as Italians who speak Spanish and live in French houses and want to be English. And, you know, I'd read my Borges and, you know, Julio Cortázar and some of my favorite writers.
But those are all characters in those writers luxuriating in being out of control.
I think they are. I mean, particularly Cortázar has the most wonderful engagement with paranoic and surreal, magic realistic.
But seeking free fall in any kind of real psychological state.
But I think it's pretty much a generation of writers who almost romanticized madness. I know that sounds reductive, but I think it's an idea that there's something poetic in psychosis, that something that's representative of the life force. You know, I'd probably get a huge argument from a lot of lovers of Cortázar, but I can't help feeling that he is. I mean, again, speaking as someone who loves this writer, I feel that he does celebrate, if not psychosis, at least the wilder recesses of the human imagination. Yeah,
I know that you've traveled quite a bit to Africa, and it's one of the things I can say, having been now a couple of times, you're shocked at the place because there's squalor and resilience, and they're not separated at all.
I know, and it's very hard to pass comment without feeling like you're saying something glib about it somehow. I mean, a lot of people get the same response. It depends on where you go, of course, and what you see, and the degree of poverty that you're witnessing, and the degree of peace or you know, conflict, or what kind of government's in place.
But wherever you go, that conflict, people talk about it. They don't forget that history exists. They don't tend to want to relegate to the past the way we do in the West.
I very rarely found anybody questioning who they were culturally anywhere I went. Well, I was just in Kenya, actually, a few weeks ago. And, you know, I mean, Nairobi has the biggest slum in Africa. I mean, it's a mind-blowingly shocking thing to see. I mean, it's a horror. And I'm in no position to even begin to think or contemplate or pass judgment on what life must be like living in a place like that. But I would still say that if you look into people's faces and of well-to-do street part of London, they don't look any happier to me. And I think that there's an extraordinary – this is dangerous talk, I know, because I'm a fairly privileged guy and I walk around privileged parts of London. But I think people look miserable a lot of the time. I would say a majority of people do not exude a lightness of spirit. And I'm not saying I saw a lightness of spirit in Nairobi, but I certainly saw – I mean, traveling around Ethiopia in the villages, and these are places where people were suffering the most appalling things. I mean, the likelihood of their children making it to 5 years old was something like one in four. And we saw, you know, people holding a child that probably wasn't going to make it. And it's very hard to know how to interact with that. It makes you want to just, you know, the facile response is to think, I can open my wallet right here and help this person, this person, this person. But how sustainable is that? Or are you just going to salve your conscience once, twice, three times, and then move on? And so to go around saying, well, people look happier, or they look, you know, they seem more joyful or something, is something one says at one's risk, I think, one's peril. But I still feel that's the perception.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to Colin Firth. His new film is the adaptation of A Single Man. The thing I found, and I spent time in Dakar in South Africa, is that sense of history and lesser sense of, I don't want to say narcissism, but self-absorption that exists in the places I've been in Africa, where you understand you're part of a continuum. There's no point in sort of fixating on your own suffering when you really are part of a bigger thing. And the culture there is not contingent on separating yourself from others.
That's interesting. Well, maybe that's why that, you know, we in the so-called West do have that haunted, rather empty look if you walk around the cities. It probably comes from the isolation that accompanies narcissism. You know, I didn't encounter narcissism in Ethiopia. And I encountered huge smiles. Now, as I said, I knew exactly what the suffering was. But I still saw smiles. And I still saw a demeanor of joy of life, even though their lives were so abject compared to anything that I would experience where I come from. So it's a very difficult thing to resolve, and it may just be to do with perception, but it's inescapable, and I think almost everybody who goes to those kind of those parts of Africa, almost everybody observes that. And I think the other thing is that they is what they observe when they come home. It's what they see when they come home. Why is everyone here looking so gloomy? Why is everyone looking so depressed? You've got everything. I've just been surrounded by people who smiled at me and hugged me and were not asking for anything, and they have nothing. And it's unforgettable, and it's something that stays with you and moves you for the rest of your life. I have to say that the hardest moment, in a way, and it was partly out of a kind of self-disgust, I suppose. But I was within 2 weeks of being in Ethiopia, I was at the Cannes Film Festival. I was in, you know, an expensive hotel, getting ready to go out, and BBC News 24 was on, and it was talking about a famine in Ethiopia, a different part of Ethiopia. I wasn't in the famine region. And they showed a father giving his infant son the last drops of a cup of water. And the narrator said, this child is dying now. And the child was the same age as my own child, and you could see the cup at the child's mouth, and children make the same face when they're trying to get water. I mean, you could see the child's jaw and lips round the rim of the cup, trying to get the last bit of water out of the cup. That's, you know, giving my own kid a cup of water. I watched that happen. It was so recognizable to me, and so human, and so immediate. And then it showed about an hour or two later, the father having just lost that child. I mean, he was so together somehow. I mean, he was crying, but he wasn't letting it go. He was trying not to cry, and he was trying to cooperate with the camera operator, the guy who was interviewing him. And my wife and I both broke down. I don't think we ever actually let it go when we were there, seeing this stuff in Ethiopia. But to be away from it and to be in a place that was so ludicrously inconsistent with that and expressive of the contradictions and, if you like, the overwhelming hypocrisy of my own life, really, in the end. We just suddenly, it hit us that how unacceptable it was that a child should die because it can't get a drink of water. I mean, we're in the south of France. That's probably 5 hours' flight to where that kid was. And we just, you know, rend our garments and, you know, we go into our sackcloth and ashes for a few minutes. And then we basically walk away and carry on. And it is the way we operate. And, you know, I am aware of of this kind of completely futile hand-wringing that, you know, we all do and that I'm doing now, really.
Well, I can only say that now you have to come back so we can talk about something else.
Okay.
My guest is Colin Firth. His new film as actor, he's starring in the adaptation of A Single Man directed by Tom Ford. Again, Colin, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you so much.
Our technical director at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with assistance from the Carnegie Recording Studios from Leszek Wojciech. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey is the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.